Welcome to the Bill Cartwright Show with Steve Cohen. Our special guest today is TV journalist and best known for the great show To Catch a Predator, Chris Hansen. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it.
You know, Chris, it's always very curious to me about people and where they're from. So can you talk about where you grew up and talk about mom and dad?
Absolutely. I was born in Chicago, Evanston Hospital in 1959. Both my mom and dad are from Chicago, a town you know very, very well, I know. And we lived on off of Milwaukee Avenue in a nice two-flat apartment building on Moody Avenue. It was great, great childhood. And went to Onahan Elementary School and used to be able to walk up to the Superdog on Milwaukee and bakery and by the forest preserve, and very fond memories. In 1968, my dad, who was in the auto industry working for Eaton, actually was Eaton Yale in town at the time, got promoted and transferred to Detroit. And it kind of broke their heart as Chicago kids, you know, with both families there. And they had just bought a home in Barrington, a new construction home. In those days, you know, 68, Barrington was way out there in the country near a river, and we're all excited to be out there. And so they sold that. We moved to Detroit and pretty much grew up in the northern suburbs, Bloomfield Hills. And I went to Brother Rice, Michigan State, was in Magic Johnson's class. He got to leave after sophomore year. I stayed and worked in radio, but it all worked out. And I see him from time to time. And I worked in Lansing, Tampa, Detroit, and then went to New York in 1993.
Talk about when you were younger, what kind of kid were you? I'm just really curious. High school, college?
I was the oldest of three, the only boy in the family. Did not particularly show early promise in any one field. Just a, you know, knock around kid, had fun, good friends. And I went to Brother Rice High School. You know, we were in good shape growing up. We weren't wealthy. You know, we were sort of on the periphery of wealth. You know, I knew, you know, kids who did have money and parents had big companies. But, you know, I had to work in the back of a bakery to pay half my tuition at Brother Rice, which is a private school, Christian Brothers of Ireland, all boys school. And it was a good thing for me because it was back in the day when, you know, there was still some discipline, still some corporate discipline, if you will. And an 81-year-old brother would take you down to the gym and put the boxing gloves on if you were smart and off to him. And it ended up being a good experience for me. And I wasn't a great student. And I became a very good student at Brother Rice because of the discipline and because of the involvement. And because, you know, my mom was very involved and we'd go to all the teachers' meetings and make sure there was a peer counselor. And you taste success as a sophomore and you get an A and suddenly you're strutting around. And I played football. By no means was a star athlete, but I played under Al Fracassa, who was a maker of men, and really came out of that high school prepared for college. And so when I went off to Michigan State, I already had in the back of my mind that I wanted to be a journalist, a television reporter. And I'd grown up about a mile and a half away from where Jimmy Hoffa had been kidnapped. And I was fascinated by that story. I used to ride my bike up there as a 15-year-old and, you know, check out the scene and the reporters doing the stories and the network correspondents in and the FBI and local police working the case. And so I got kind of bit by the bug then. So when I went off to Michigan State, I signed up for the student radio station. And, you know, at 18, I was a journalist by my own designation.
Now, did you have anybody you looked up to as a journalist or anybody that mentored you?
Sure. Bill Bonds was a local anchor in Detroit and a very gifted communicator and a brilliant fellow. And as it turned out, he was best friends with the father of my best friend growing up. And so I met him at 16, 17 years old, and he immediately took me under his wing. And he was a great character and a second father to me in a lot of different ways. And you know, he was a guy who could have easily been at the network and did a stint in New York and a stint in LA and found his, you know, home at the anchor desk in Detroit and you know, was one of those powerful anchormen who people revered and listened to and was a colorful character in his own right. And, you know, to be shoulder to shoulder with him and break some stories now and again and to have him as a mentor and a teacher and to guide you in terms of writing and what people think is important and how to communicate was very, very valuable as a young man, because I had interned at Channel 7 in Detroit when I was in college, and then came back and worked there a few years later in 1984. So it was a wonderful experience, and it was a great town in which to be a reporter for 10 years, because it was very competitive. We just didn't compete with the other TV stations. We competed with the newspapers, and it was cutthroat. I mean, it was all or nothing journalism. I mean, you went out to win every single day.
Talk about that. Talk about your first big story that you worked on as a news reporter.
You know, there were some stories that were good scoops in Lansing. I was covering the state capitol. Then in Tampa, I was down there for 2.5 years and, you know, got to know some of the law enforcement people and got behind the scenes. But it really was in Detroit when about a year and a half into my tenure there, there was a horrific, frightening kidnapping of a young guy, an eighth grader, if I recall correctly, in a suburb outside of Detroit. And this kid was kidnapped riding his bike Labor Day weekend in 85, I think. And Sean Moore was his name. And his dad was the publisher of the local newspapers outside of a town called Brighton. And it captivated the entire city of Detroit. And so I was the guy on the story, and I covered it. I covered it hard. It turned out that he had been kidnapped by a 20-something-year-old named Ronald Lloyd Bailey. And he had taken the young boy, sadly, up to his family's cottage in northern Michigan and assaulted him and killed him. And the manhunt was then on for Ronald Lloyd Bailey. And, you know, I had access to his family and the victim's family and was in on the manhunt. And we got on a plane and flew down. That was, you know, back in the days when we were network owned and we spared no expense covering local stories, and followed it down there. And then figured out who the psychiatrist who was treating the killer was and his background. And he had molested the boy, allegedly, the killer. And then turned out he was good for another murder. And this thing, you know, for a period of years went on and covered the trial. And it was something. And not only was it an important story, but I was breaking news on it. And suddenly people were willing to talk to me and not other reporters. And that gave me a great deal of credibility with law enforcement. And, you know, we went on to break the White Boy Rick story, which became a movie and a documentary, and the Chambers Brothers drug gang story, where they had taken home videos of themselves, and, you know, in their ill-gotten wealth. And I got access to that. It had good sources in the police department, in the FBI, and it led to a lot of big breaking stories. And so I became elevated to a higher level of reporter. And, you know, I was really dedicated to it. And I still am today, but it was, you know, I got a taste of that early success and what it takes to, you know, to be a reporter, not just to, you know, go to a news conference, but to get information, to develop personal relationships with people who had information, who would then trust you with that, and then to do the right thing with it. And it's currency in my business. You know, it was a lesson I learned very well in Detroit, and I took it with me to the network. And, you know, still today, right before hopping on with you, I was in a meeting with one of the networks on a series, and you know, those lessons continue today, you know, 40 years into the business.
That's awesome. you've had such a great career. I do want to get to this, but I don't want to skip anything over. So to catch a predator, where did that idea come from?
I was talking to a reporter friend of mine who told me about the online watchdog group Perverted Justice. And we reached out to them. And I thought that if we could use their ability to pose as young teens online and combine that with our ability to wire a house with hidden cameras and microphones, it could be very compelling television and important television, because it was, you know, 2004 and we were starting to get anecdotal reports about children being harmed online and meeting strangers online and being sexually abused online and lured. And I pitched the story at Dateline, and I never imagined it would become what it did. I thought it would be a one-off segment on Dateline. And we did it. And I was driving out to the location. It was a Sting House in Long Island, Bethpage, Long Island. And I thought, you know, what if nobody shows up? What if I just wasted tens of thousands of dollars in the network's money? And with that, my producer calls and said, where the hell are you? We've got two guys scheduled to show up in 45 minutes. And, you know, 2.5 days into it, we had 17 guys servicing that investigation, including a New York City firefighter. And, you know, we didn't have law enforcement involved in that first investigation. We had security there for me and for the entire crew, but, you know, these guys just walked away. They prosecuted the firefighter and that was it. So we played with the format of it and we went back and forth, and it was obviously more than just one segment, and it aired, and, you know, it really got a response for all the reasons that we thought it would. It was very compelling on television. We took people on a journey of discovery, and, you know, we watched a crime during its commission. And so we decided to do it again in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. And, you know, more guys showed up. And we had a rabbi and a teacher and all kinds of characters. And then we had the opportunity in the third investigation to partner with law enforcement, which was what we did. And it was a much more socially responsible way of doing the show because, you know, they just didn't walk off into the sunset. Now, some of these other guys were ultimately prosecuted, but it was more difficult for law enforcement to come back in and get the information prosecuted than to actually have the transcripts and watch this go down. And so from that point on, we always had a partnership with law enforcement.
I think this is going to be hard. Give me two of your cases that you talked about rabbis and teachers and all these really professional people, but give me two examples of something that you were really surprised about.
Well, I'm surprised that 17 years later, we're still out there doing it. That's the main thing I'm surprised about. I mean, I thought at some point guys would stop showing up, but, you know, just recently in Michigan, we did another one and we're planning more, and they continue to show up. What surprises me, Bill, is that these people, prominent people with a lot to lose, would risk it all on the notion that they could have sex with a 13 or 14 year old boy or girl. And I don't know where this comes from. I understand and have interviewed many, many experts on pedophilia and predatory behavior and not being able to control your urges, but I still don't get what the draw is. But I can tell you this, that many of these guys don't stand out of a crowd. You know, they could be sitting in an arena watching you play basketball years ago, or, you know, ultimately watching this show at some point. But they cross this line between fantasy and reality. They say things they wouldn't normally say in person online. There's the addictive nature of the internet and the 24/7 access. And I think there are people predisposed to, you know, this sort of illicit relationship with attractions towards young people. And without the internet, they probably wouldn't do it, but they get caught up and they blur this line between fantasy and reality, and suddenly they're knocking on our door. There's another category of heavy hitters. I mean, hardcore pedophiles, predators who would do this no matter what, and this in-between area. Then I think there is a third category of younger guys, 19, 20, 21, who are socially inept and don't have a life outside of the internet and come across somebody in a chat room or a social platform and figure, well, she's 4 years younger than me. At some point we'll catch up if it works out. And it's a Romeo Juliet thing and it's okay. And it's not okay because, you know, some people have sympathy for somebody who gets caught in one of these things who's 19, 20, 21 or 22. And, you know, you should let them go or not identify them. And my answer to that is, what's the difference in the danger posed by a 21-year-old versus a 28-year-old to a 12-year-old girl? And the answer is, in my opinion, none. They're just as culpable. The punishment may be different. The treatment might be different. The ability to never do it again might be different, to be rapped on the nose and say, you know, this is horrible, wrong, illegal, don't do it again. And we've seen guys turn their lives around in that scenario. But we've also seen guys go right back out and get caught again trying to pick up a child online. After this podcast, I'm going to do mine for next week. And it revolves around a guy who got caught by the decoys once, was not prosecuted because it was early on as people started to do these things, got caught in one of our cases, was prosecuted. And while he was out on bail, got caught a third time. So what are the odds this guy is going to try it again? I mean, they're pretty good if you don't lock him up and get his attention, I would argue.
Talk about your most dangerous situation.
In the Predator cases, there was, I think the most dangerous situation happened in Flagler Beach, Florida. And we had, you know, dozens of guys show up during an investigation over 3 or 4 days. And we had one guy who said he was a cop. And he was, we didn't know whether he was a former cop or whether he was a current cop or whether he was, you know, BSing us or not. And it was a particularly graphic chat. And it was sexually violent and vile. And it went on for 3 or 4 days. And we started to think, well, this guy's not going to show up. So we wrap for the day on a Saturday night and it's late. And we go back to the hotel and we're having a meal and a drink. And suddenly pagers are going off and cell phones are going off all over the place. And it's a decoy saying this guy is telling me he's right there near the house. And we didn't have a chance to turn it all back on and get there. So the police ultimately arrested him on a traffic stop. And they had probable cause to charge him in the case. And not only was he an active cop at the Florida-Georgia border, Florida-Alabama border, rather, he had in his car, he had in his pocket a 38 caliber pistol loaded in his pocket. In his car, he had an assault rifle, a shotgun, and a 45 with 800 rounds of ammunition. He had duct tape, he had rope, he had a chainsaw, he had bulletproof vests. I mean, he was ready to go to battle. So the question is, what could have happened had that guy walked in armed? Now, I don't think he would have got a shot off at me because there are guys there to protect me. But I'd hate to see any sort of a scenario where there was bloodshed over this, you know, whether it was our fault or not. So I literally think in that particular scenario, we dodged a bullet, you know.
I know that you've done a lot, Chris, and every day you're getting recognized for To Catch a Predator, but what are some stories that you've covered outside of the Predator franchise? You have won multiple Emmys. I believe it's 10, correct?
That is correct. Thank you for noting that. I can't take all the credit for this. I've worked with some amazingly talented people over the years, and so I have tipped my hat to produce. Done a lot of the work, including you. I think unquestionably there was a story we did. I mean, I'm proud of a lot of the work that we've done, and I think we've helped a lot of people in a lot of different ways. But we did an undercover operation with a NGO in Cambodia where we posed as American sex tourists, and along with this NGO and some very dedicated investigators, private investigators down there, we infiltrated a brothel outside of Phnom Penh where Americans and Europeans were going for sex with girls as young as 5 and 6 years old. And we had hidden camera video of what was going on there. And then we went along on the bus and we confronted the people and we caught Americans down there, including an American physician who I confronted actually in Guam, believe it or not. And we put a whole hour together on it. And it was really eye-opening, really compelling, and it got people's attention. We went back and we rescued 37, we didn't rescue, but we covered the rescue of 37 children, some of whom went to a bridge school, turned their lives around, and we visited them. 4 years later, I went back to do a follow-up story, and we interviewed them, and you know, it was kind of a difficult interview because they speak Khmer, and my Khmer is not fluent, obviously. But we got the message across, and lovely children, and they really didn't know my exact role, but they knew that they were in a better place and I had something to do with it. And this big, tall Americans there, and we finished the interview and they said, when are you going back to the United States? I said, well, I'm going back tomorrow. And they said, you guys started to get sad. And I said, well, you know, I do have to go back. I have to do the story. And believe me, I'd love to take you all with me, but you know, you're in a good place here. And they said, well, can we go to the airport with you? And I said, well, if it's okay with the people at the school, that's obviously fine by me. And the director leans over to me and says, you know, I know that you've got an emotional connection with these girls, but the reason that they want to go to the airport with you is it's the only Dairy Queen in Phnom Penh. I said, well, that's fine. I think the network can pop for, you know, a half dozen banana splits. I'm happy to do that. And so we go to the airport and the tuk-tuk arrives with all the girls on board. They're all dressed, you know, beautifully. And we go to the Dairy Queen and we have all the banana splits and we're chit-chatting as best as we can. And we go to wrap up, pay the tab, all of, you know, $14, whatever it is. And I go to leave and they're following me and we're, you know, do the goodbye thing and the culturally appropriate stuff. And they keep following me and the cameraman shooting and the producers there. And in the Phnom Penh airport, there's a two-story glass wall that separates the outside to the inside where you check in. And I, they're still there. And I walk in and we say goodbye for the 15th time. And I go to check in to get my ticket. And I turn around and they're got their hands against the, pressed against the glass and they're crying. Now I'm crying. And this whole moment is captured, you know, on video. And it made for one of the most compelling moments of my career. I get choked up just thinking about it. But it's a reminder that we have very important jobs. We have an important duty as journalists to educate people, to create a dialogue that didn't exist before, and to try to help folks out. And you don't get opportunities like that one very often, quite honestly. It's expensive, it's dangerous. You know, it's all the things that make network standards people and lawyers very concerned. But you know, we were able to do it. And so that was a big deal.
Chris, what's next for you? Are you you're doing such a great job of doing what you're doing now, but what do you feel?
Well, like I think what we're up to now, we've got two series on Discovery Plus, which is the Discovery streaming platform, Onision in Real Life and Unseemly, the Peter Nygaard investigation. So I'm not just doing, you know, the reporting on the stories. I'm also executive producer, one of the executive producers on them. So that's been very, very fulfilling. And so I've got two or three major projects along those lines, crime investigative things in the works. We're rebooting in a different era, the Predator series. And I, in fact, as we speak here today, just finished a meeting with one of the networks on that. And that's going to be great and important. I mean, you think about 17 years ago when we started it, again, we were in chat rooms and AOL on Yahoo. Well, today the number of platforms is so exploded that, we're not even able to keep track of them, but you know, this activity is still going on more than ever before because of the explosion of platforms and because of the exposure of children to potential predators and because kids are spending more time online, especially during the pandemic, which is why we decided to do our podcast, Predators I've Caught, where we look back at these cases and we see where these people are now. And you know, we learn a lesson from each one of them because in the moment, it goes by so quickly, we can now have perspective on some of these cases. And it's, people have reacted well to it. It's something that a lot of folks listen to. And so we've got that going. And another podcast, we're on YouTube, and suddenly that has become a job. I never thought that I'd end up with 370,000 some subscribers. And so people look at that, and we do social media, and it's a pretty full schedule around Hanson News Bureau here.
Stevie, I'm going to give you a last shot.
Well, I know we always like to ask people about their family, and Chris is a great family man. But Chris, tell us about your family and what you've been up to.
Well, we're blended. I have two sons, Chase and Connor. Chase lives in Brooklyn, and he's a film camera television guy and works on set and does very, very well. He's worked on some of my shows over the years and he loves it. He loves the behind the scenes work and he's done very well with it. And then Connor, who's a ham like I am, he's a reporter in Oklahoma City and he's probably going to make a move pretty soon here. And I have two younger stepkids who are in college, who are lovely and wonderful, and a wonderful fiance, Gabrielle. And we're looking at a wedding later this fall, and life is good. Life is good.
Awesome. Chris, thank you so much. You're such a great storyteller. Care so much about people, helping people. Everybody loves your show.
Well,
my whole family watches your show. It is really enlightening. So thank you so much for being on. And if you get to Chicago, we're gonna have a meal. We're gonna bring Steve. We're gonna go to my restaurant, go to Froggy's, hang out a little bit.
Yeah, we'll do that for sure.
Hopefully your son gets the job out in one of those cities.
Yeah, I think that's gonna happen. I don't want to jinx it, but I think he's in pretty good shape. He's people ask, you know, is he good? I said he's better than I was at that age, but now we just got to see how lucky he gets.
Awesome.
He's got the fire in the belly. He'll be fun. He'll do very
thanks,
well.
Guys.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Bill. It was a pleasure.